Thank you, Bob. Good morning, friends. My name is Ray, and I'm an alcoholic. I'm a member of the Congress Heights Group in Oxon Hill, Maryland. And through the grace of God and the help of the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, and in places like this and with people like you, it's possible for me to say that I had my last drink a little over 11 years ago. And for this, I'm certainly grateful. I could never have done it without you. Now, it's about this time that I get a little confused. Joe was kind to me. He let me think about this for 10 months. And it's about this time I asked myself why I said yes. I really do get confused when I begin because I just really don't know why that is. It never lessens any. It takes me a couple minutes to get squared away. The confusion. That reminds me of a story, too, really. These two guys rode hunting. One guy was an alcoholic and the other guy was normal, whatever the hell that is. And they came on this pond and the farmer's daughter was in swimming. And she got out and she was nude. And they walked a little closer, and the closer they got, the better she looked. Now that goes. And they walked a little closer, and she came directly toward them. And everything was going along fine, and they got abreast with one another. And the normal guy walks up to her, and he whispers in her ear, he says, "Are you game?" And she said, "Yeah." And the alcoholic shot her. See, if I tell you where I'm coming from, you won't expect much. Oh, by the way, I have a pass. I have a pass. Before I start, that authenticates things. It's a privilege to be in Atlanta. My first visit here, and I've been treated more than well, or better than well. I've just simply probably been treated too good. I'm not really sure of that, but it's been really an adventure for me. The big book of Alcoholics Anonymous suggests that when we're privileged to do the thing that I'm going to attempt to do this morning, we should tell a little about our lives before we drank, what happened while we were drinking, and what our lives have become since we've been sober members of Alcoholics Anonymous. And in the 3 short hours that have been allotted me, I'm going to attempt to do that. Now, I was born, like most of us, and I was born in the state of Virginia. And as soon as I was big enough to see where I was, I got the hell out of there. And I've been gone ever since. My hometown is Fredericksburg, Virginia. Geographic reasons that I do selected that when I was in the military. Everybody had to be from somewhere. But I was actually born 6 miles south of Fredericksburg in the country. A little place called Port Royal Forks. Was in those days, where the 2 and 17 divide and the old Tidewater Trail start there. But they've since found it necessary to change the name of that. It's now New Post. And that ought to excite the hell out of everybody. I'm the 3rd of 5 children, 4 boys and a girl, and my mom and dad and I, the 7 of us, we're living in a 4-room house. We had a little house out in the back of the big house, and the big house wasn't all that big. And that's where we were, and we were extremely poor. I had been trying for a long time to just find some way to express how poor we really were. I thought we were anyway. And I read in a Sunday paper the other day that this guy, and I identify with this man, he said that they were so poor around his house, they didn't have any clothes. And when he was about 10 years old, they bought him a cap so he could look out of the window. I remember the day, I don't remember the man, my father, he was a steam shovel operator, and he hadn't been working for a long time. I know that because we hadn't been eating. I hadn't anyway, and he had gotten a job with the Bethlehem Steel Company in Sparrows Point, Maryland. And we were running around the house that was just almost ecstatic that Dad was going to work and we could start doing the things that other people had been doing all the time, like eating and wearing shoes and stuff like that. And we were just getting all his belongings together and we were putting them in his Model A Ford. I'm not really that old. It was a relic at the time, you think. We got him all together and he went off and he went on and he went on and on actually, he was found 28 years later. Through the efforts of a good detective and a lot of expense of my older brother. What he had done, he had ran off with the other woman. That's what they called it in those days, and I guess it would be the same thing today if that happened. The same thing would apply. He hadn't been gone very long, I know that, and nobody could find him, and they decided that he had deserted the family, which he had. Things got a lot worse. We became a ward, my mother and my brothers, my sister and I, became a ward of the state of Virginia, which meant we went on a relief roll. Today it's public assistance, same thing. The powers that were at that time, mixed up in that thing, decided that my mom wasn't able to take care of all five of us, so they took the two oldest boys, and they put them in foster homes down near Richmond, Virginia. And I was 8 years old, and I automatically became the man of the house. And from age 8 until age 17, when I was first taken drunk, the only adjective that I know to describe my life is just devastating. I had a younger brother and a baby sister that I felt the most overwhelming responsibility toward or for, and I have absolutely no idea why. But I did. And I thought they were in my charge or in my care, and it was up to me to see that they were taken care of. And this is the way my life was at that time. There were mental and emotional things or scars that happened to me in those years that I don't think I'll overcome. And I certainly don't want to give you the impression that I'm sickly, because that's not true. But I think it had a lot to do with what I had to offer society. I think we were supposed to have it together pretty much by the time we were 18. And I hadn't gone very far by the time I was 18, really. In that area of my life, anyway. To tell you a little about that, like most people, I went to school a little bit. We had this real huge school there, and they had a partition in the center of it, country school. And the first four grades were in one end of it, first, second, third, and fourth grade here. The partition in the fifth, sixth, seventh grade was in the other end. And I started school there, and I passed the first, second, and third grade with no problem at all. None. And I got into fourth grade. Now, I'd heard this work all these 4 years, and I couldn't pass. I got into fourth grade, and I just could not get out of the fourth grade. There were people passing me, you know, they come into first grade. And I finally got out of it. Finally. And I was so happy. And I went home, and sometime during that evening, that very evening, for my graduation from the fourth grade, somebody mentioned to me that I ought to go to the other end of that building. And you know, even then, as dumb as I was, and by my own calculations, by the time I got over to the other end of that building, I'd have been 35. And I said, I'm absolutely not going to spend my life in school. Not the rest of it, anyway. So that was the end of my formal education. And it's been the end of it as a matter of fact. And I just went around through the community making whatever monies that I could make to supplement the money that my mom got from the welfare check. And that's the way my life was. Now, I was first taken drunk when I was 17, and I think really that the only three significant things that I can get out of my first 17 years anyway, and one of those was that I damn near starved to death. The other thing was I was dumb as hell. And the third thing is I sucked my thumb until I was 13. This thumb right here. Just, it was as white as that lady's slacks up to about there. Yeah. Yeah. And I sucked my thumb and played with my ear. It was cool. The lobe was cool. And this one got warm. I played with this one. You see? And if both of them got warm and you were standing around, I'd play with yours. Yeah. And I felt secure doing that. I knew that that was the reason I did that. Now, you know today, though, a psychiatrist, he could get about 8 months out of that. Yeah. But I knew I felt better when my thumb was in my mouth, and I kept it there all the time. And at age 17, I was in Fredericksburg one day, and I don't know why, but I was just there. And we congregated in one section of the park there. The park in the center of the city. All the people my age at that time did that. And I walked in there one day. It was during the week. And one of my buddies was sitting on the bench there. And I went over and sat down next to him. And he informed me that he had sent an older man over the ABC store to get a bottle of wine. Didn't mean a damn thing to me. I didn't know anything about the effects of alcohol. I never tasted it. The only thing I knew about alcohol, I had an uncle, Uncle Lewis. And he made homebrew. And I knew it was brown, and I knew they put it in bottles, and I knew it exploded in the middle of the night. And that's all I know about it. Because I'd be visiting there, and one of those things would go off, and I would go straight up, and they'd say, "Oh, lie down, it's just one of those things." And I said, "Okay." And the man brought the bottle of wine back and handed it to my buddy, and he took the top off of it. It had five stars on the label. I don't know the name of it. I remember that. And he took the top off it, and he took a drink. And he handed it to me, and I took a drink. Now, up to this point in time in my life, I had always apologized to everybody that I'd met simply for being born. And I always felt like I was standing in somebody else's place, breathing somebody else's air, and I was just a non-entity, or a non-person. I probably felt a lot like the hole in the donut looks. Really. But when that wine, when that ethyl alcohol touched my brain on that day when I was 17 years of age, I believe today, standing here, that I became an alcoholic. I was an instant alcoholic. I'd just been walking around for 17 years waiting to happen. And I say that for many reasons, and I think the most important one is to me, is that from that day on, for the next 20 years on a daily basis, I drank something that contained the chemical alcohol each and every day of that time, that it was humanly possible to get it. And I never, ever entertained the thought of stopping drinking. To this point in time, as I stand here today, I have never thought to myself, "Ray, you ought to stop drinking." I've never thought that. I got sober in jail, and thousands of people have, but I have never thought of me stopping drinking. It was just an absolute, total obsession with me from the word go. And I indulged myself almost 20 years to the month that I drank. Now, I left that park that day, and I went on about my life for the next 20 years. And in many areas of my life, I functioned well. And in one area of my life, I excelled. Anyway, by my standards, I know that. But you see, when it came to the drug alcohol, I was strangely insane. And I didn't know that. I didn't know that. I knew that I had to drink. I knew that. Every time anybody mentioned anything about me not drinking, I wouldn't compute that. And looking back now, I can remember that. I think there's some things that are just so distasteful to the human mind that we just don't compute, no matter what it is. And that was what it was with me. And looking back now, the reason that I couldn't compute that, because they were asking me to take the only thing out of my life that made my life bearable. And I couldn't stand that. So I just didn't compute it. And I went on another man in the room my age, 31, 32, we would have put a checklist back on the wall back there, and we'd walk back to that checklist, we probably did almost the identical same things. Almost. There's certainly not that much difference in my life, other than I drank every day. At age 21, I was married to a fine human being. She still is. At age 23, I went in the military. And that's a little old, but Korea was going on at the time. And things were really jumping over there. I mean, they were raising hell. And they put me in the army. They drafted me. I want to make that perfectly clear. And they put me in the army. And they put me in the medical corps. And they put me in basic training down in Camp Pickett, Virginia. And we went through the cycle of basic training, 16 weeks. And we got out of that. It was 1,000 people. And I knew I was going to Korea. You know, I just knew it because that was the only reason I was there. And he put us in this huge building on graduation day, and out of the 1,000 men, they put 13 of us in a corner over here, and he said, "You men are going to Austria." I had never heard of it. Never heard. And I nudged one of my buddies. I said, "Hey, man, where's Austria?" He says, "It's nowhere near Korea." I said, "I'm ready. I'm ready. Right now. I'm ready." Yep. I'm a coward when it comes to people shooting at me or cutting on me, and I wanted to go right then. They talked about giving us a 10-day delay en route. I didn't want that for fear they were going to change their mind. And I wanted to go right now because I went home for 10 days, and I went to Austria. And for the next 19 months, I had a holiday. And that's the best way I can describe it. It's the only way to describe that. I had been over there a little while, and we were billeted in a hotel in Zellamsee, Austria. And that ought to excite the hell out of some people, too. And I got some stripes. Didn't earn them, I don't think. And the way I got them was the hotel had a long corridor. And I was at the other end of the corridor one day, and here comes this guy running down the corridor with a bunch of stripes in his hand. He was handing them to everybody else, and he gave me some. I just happened to be standing there in the right place. In the right place. Yeah. And I didn't know what to do. I knew I hadn't done anything to earn them, so I waited, and everybody else was sewing theirs on, so what the hell, I sewed mine on. And I used them to the limit. To the limit, I used them. I really did. Now, I'm not going to tell you any war stories because I don't have any. Really, not that kind of combat anyway. But the last 11 months, I think, approximately 11 months that I was in Austria, my job was to replace the NCOs in charge of the dispensaries that were rotating, that they didn't have a permanent replacement for, and that was what I did almost the last year that I was there. And I had a Jeep, I had a driver, I had a special privilege pass, and I went and came as I chose. And that's hard for me to believe now, but that's the way it was. Sometime I'd go to a unit and I wouldn't even unpack. I'd only be there 2 or 3 days and a replacement would come in and I'd just move on. I had everything but money. Everything. And they just weren't paying me enough money to drink the way I needed to drink at that time. And that's all there was to that. And I go into this story because it's necessary for me. It's just a part of my life. And it's the first insane thing that I did to obtain booze. I was over there and I was pulling CQ one night because I was broke. And at this, in these times, now this was 1953, VD was a no-no. The time changes everything. I understand that as a line of duty. And some people were getting themselves in trouble, and I was in a dispensary one night, and this master sergeant walked in to me and he was in trouble. And if he went through the chain of command, he could lose a stripe, and he didn't want to lose a stripe. And he asked me if I could help him out, and I said, "Man, you're crazy. You're crazy. They would shoot me if I were to do something like that. So I borrowed some money the next day, and I went downtown, and I went up to pay my check, and I was broke again. And on the way back to the billets, I said to myself, well, maybe I do things like that. You know, maybe. And I was all drunk. Then I got thinking to myself, shoot who? They ain't shooting me. When I was sober, they shoot me. But when I was drunk, they ain't shooting me. So what actually happened was, I looked this guy up the next day. And I helped him out. And it's just like McDonald's hamburgers. I can assure you this. If you put a good product on the market, it will sell. It will sell. And what happened to me was, for the first time in my life, I went into business. It was in the penicillin business. And it was Uncle Sam's penicillin. There was no overhead. No income tax. Can you imagine that? All profits. All profits. And it was crazy. It was insane. But you know, I never looked at this as stealing. I never thought of this as stealing anything, because every dime that we made, I had two partners. Every dime that we made in this endeavor, we spent on booze. Either we drank it up or somebody did. We didn't send any of it home. And business got so good, really, to tell you, or so bad, however you want to look at it, that we had to set a going price at this stuff. A master sergeant was $20, sergeant first class $15, buck sergeant's $10, and if I thought I was going to have something to go to bed, I'd just give it away. And things were really going along fine. Fine. And I finally rotated. When I left, I sold my interest for $15. I sold my part of the business. And I wished them well. And I came on home, and I was 24, maybe 25 by now. And I was honored as discharged. We spent it. I hadn't been caught, really. And I got out of the Army, and my wife was working at the time. I was married then. And I walked around, and I had no training. No training whatsoever. None. And I just walked around, and I walked past a construction job one day. The only thing I'd ever done, I'd short-order-cooked a little bit, and I had driven a truck, a pie truck. They used to call me the singing pie man. I walked past this construction job one day, and I went inside, and I found the superintendent, and I asked him for a job, and he gave me one. Dumb as hell. I didn't know nothing, and he put me in a sand pile. He took me out, and he said, this is a sand pile. I must have looked dumb. And he said, this is a mortar box, and this is a chopping hoe. It's really a mixing hoe is what it was. And he said, you put so much sand in the box, and so much cement, so much lime, you mix it up. And I did that for 3 years. And I mixed an awful lot of mortar. Awful lot of mortar. I was a laborer. There's nothing wrong with that. And if you ever see anybody on a job carrying a hide, that guy knows something. I never could learn to carry a hide. There's a balance to that thing. It makes it easier. It does. I had to carry all the mortar that I mixed in those 3 years in a 5-gallon bucket. Yeah? They weighed 68 pounds a bucket, and I carried them on my left shoulder. And I carried so damn much of that stuff today, physically, my left shoulder is lower than my right. Doesn't hurt, but it is. And I went on like this in my life, and my wife and I were living a good existence, a good life, nothing extravagant, of course. And I certainly wasn't making any money to amount to anything. And then after 3 years of this labor, I finally became a mechanic. They put me with tools, or I became a mechanic. It's the lingo on the trade. And the first two paydays, I at least doubled my salary for each time that I had, each work pay that I had drawn. But on the third pay, I had worked some overtime. I was union. And I opened that envelope when I got home that night, and there was more money in that thing than I ever thought that I'd ever be able to earn. And something happened to me about that. And I became almost obsessed with the dollar bill as I had with the alcohol back on that park bench in Fredericksburg. And I became totally greedy. And anything that got in my way I believe I would have run over my grandmother. And that's not extreme, I don't think. I was just obsessed with that. And I really believe the period of time in my life, from the time this happened to me until the time that I was no longer able to earn any money, I was sicker then than I've ever been before or since in my life. Because I was spiritually sick. I was just terribly spiritually sick. Because anybody got in my way between me and that dollar bill, I'd move you regardless of what I'd had to do. And I had no respect whatsoever for humankind. None. And whatever I had to do to get the dollar bill, that's what I did. And in 1960, no, before this, I became so obsessed with this, that night I sat down and I wondered to myself, now how am I going to eliminate all these people from messing with my money before it gets to me? Yeah, first thought. And about a week later, I went into business for myself. And I eliminated everybody. And in 1960, I was making money so fast, I couldn't even count it. And I don't mean this room full of money, and I don't mean anything like that, but I mean by my standards, the cash flow in my business was so rapid, I couldn't keep up with it. Nobody was going to steal anything because I'd seen to that. I had 4 trucks on the road, I had a minimum of 7 people working for me, and as far as finances were concerned, I had arrived by my standards anyway. I rode past a house one day, it was under construction, down in our area, and I walked in and talked to the builder, and the next afternoon I bought it. Beautiful home. Had a 2-car garage, a car in each garage, and while the house was under construction, I asked the builder to put me a barbecue pit in the backyard. And there was certainly nothing wrong with that, and I kind of feel a little embarrassed about telling you about this, because looking at this fine group of people, I feel almost all alone. See, I was the type of guy that always tried to keep up with the Joneses. And I know I feel very lonely here about that. I was just obsessed with that. Totally obsessed with what you could see of me. Because I knew what I was on the inside. But I thought maybe I could clean that up a little bit with nice clothes and a nice ring and a big car, a nice smile, or whatever I needed to do. But on the inside, I knew I was rotten. I knew that. And the only way I had to measure me was what my accountant told me I was worth, or what I could look in my bank balance and see I was worth, or the car that I was driving down the street. That was my total worth as a member of humankind, and I knew that. And things went on, and this was my thinking in those years. All of those years. This was the way I operated. The house next door was sold. It was under construction. The guy bought it. Nice guy, I think. I never met him. And he must have lived sort of the same way that I did. You know, his ideas must have been about the same. It was certainly a suburban atmosphere. And he had the builder put him a barbecue pit in his backyard. That was bigger than mine. And I don't have to tell you what happened to my barbecue pit. And the essence of this whole story is, by the time this little battle was over, my barbecue pit was damn near as big as my house. Yeah. And that was the way I lived. That was the way I lived. Now, alcoholism is an illness, and it's progressive. And in case someone overtold you, it's always down. Always. The progression of alcoholism is down. And these things that I had gained in my life, I knew that I was going to lose, and I lost them exactly the same way I gained them, one at a time. It just went. That's the way it was to it. The first thing to go was my business. After a lot of turmoil and a lot of trying and a lot of conniving and cheating and lying, I eventually lost my business. Which is just SOP for the alcoholic. It was for this one anyway. I had a good lawyer. We were able to steal enough money that I could keep my house. I could still live in my house. And I went back to work with my tools as a mechanic, and I didn't have to lay out any large sums of money. So I didn't have to change my lifestyle one iota. Not a bit. I still had the nice cars, a nice home, and everything was fine. And this went on for a time. I don't know how long. But see, alcoholism is progressive and it's down. Always. And the day came, eventually, that I was no longer physically or mentally capable of giving a man a day's work as a mechanic. So I had to go back to the mortar box from where I'd started. It was just a complete circle in my life, all the way around. And at this time, everything was gone. Everything was gone. My wife and I, and one child, by this time, he was 9, were living in a rooming house. At 12th and Pennsylvania Avenue Southeast in Washington, D.C. is where it was. It could have been in Macon, or it could have been in Columbus. Alcoholism is the same, no matter where it happens. And it was a $10 a week rooming house. The bathroom was in the hallway. And we shared the same bed, the three of us. And we were eventually evicted from that. And what my wife was cooking on at that time was a hot plate that I had stolen, and whatever she cooked I had stolen, because I certainly wasn't going to spend my wine money for anything as ridiculous as food. And that's the way our life was. Now, we came back to this room one day, the three of us, and I don't know why we were together, because we never were. And we walked up on the porch, and the landlady had put whatever our belongings were, as meager as they were, on the outside, laid them on the porch, and she wouldn't even allow us to go inside to see whether or not she'd overlooked anything. And the hot plate was laying on top of everything, and I can see that now as well as I can this lady. And I hope I never forget that. And she wouldn't let us inside, so my wife, we walked back down on 12th Street, this is just geographics, and she took the boy by the hand and started walking down toward the Navy Yard. Her brother worked there. And I just turned around and got on Pennsylvania Avenue and started walking toward the Capitol building. And not a word was said. We didn't exchange one word. And I don't guess anything needed to be said. And at that time, we'd been married for 13 years. And for the next 2 years, I didn't have a bed to go to. I was a guy that you see sitting in the doorway with the overcoat on, with the stubble beard. Actually, the only thing I owned two of the last 2 years that I drank was overcoats. Yeah. Every time I saw an overcoat that wasn't wrapped around somebody, I'd put it on. Yeah. Yeah. Because I knew it was going to get cold or wet. Maybe I'd be able to hock it. And I'm certainly not trying to promote anything, but the easiest thing I know of to steal, and I've sold a lot of things, is an overcoat. Nobody ever pays any attention to that, and that's not a promotional thing. It's just a statement. And for the next 14 months, the first 14 months of the 2 years, the last 2 years that I drank, and it can be, please God, I lived in the metropolitan Washington proper, Washington, D.C. And I just walked right on down from where I was. I walked right straight to the bus station, Greyhound bus station, because I knew that that's where I belonged. And you know, I rode past that same bus station one time. I was a Buick man in those days, and a Buick that had less than 300 miles on it. And I looked over there and canvassed the place because I knew someday I'd be there. And I had just driven a new automobile out of the showroom because I knew that what alcohol did to people. And I wasn't a damn fool. I was dumb as hell, but I wasn't a damn fool. And I knew that I would eventually come to that. But I was so obsessed with the alcohol that I could not stop drinking. I couldn't stop that. There wasn't any point in me even thinking. So for the first 14 months I was out there, I just went from place to place, and I'd gotten to the place after a while that I could no longer fight for myself. I couldn't get my own booze, so I just had to follow around people and make sure that they didn't get angry with me to give me a drink of their wine. My favorite drink the last 2 years that I drank was Wild Irish Rose. That's the only wine that I know of that's never seen a grape. Not one. Not one. None. It's just all chemical. Oh, and I was chemicaled up. I was really chemicaled up. And I just get with these people, and they aren't hard to spot, especially when you go to the bus station, now town anyway. I knew the gospel mission was there, the place that they pray over you. And I went there. I canvassed all this. I checked all this out previous to this. And I just get with the groups, and I'd always wake up in these pads. No furniture, just wall-to-wall drunks. And I remember one time I woke up in Georgetown, affluent area, supposed to be. I don't know how we got in there, but there must have been 45 people, just wall-to-wall in this pad and not one stick of furniture, none. And if you look over the crowd, it looked like United Nations. Yeah, it's just a little bit of everything. And we'd pair off in sixes or sevens. One of them be burning incense. I didn't want to do that. I wanted to find a wine bottle. And wherever the wine bottle was in the middle of the crowd, I'd sit down. And eventually they'd give me a drink. And this was my life. And what happened to me the day that I walked away from my wife and son was that I just absolutely and totally succumbed to the drug alcohol. And that was the only thing in my life that made any difference to me. And I didn't let anybody know where I was. I didn't call my brothers, a mother, a sister, my wife, because I knew they'd come get me and take my bottle away from me, and I couldn't stand that. So I just hid. And I knew I was dying. And that's not being dramatic. I just knew that I was dying. But I couldn't stop drinking. I just couldn't stand the thought of that. So I just hid. Now, the last 10 months of my drinking, or the 2 years that I was out there, three other winos lived in a shack on a dump. Now, that didn't mean anything to anybody but me. And I can tell you one thing, that I was still thinking like an alcoholic. It was the biggest dump in the metropolitan Washington area. Yes. Yeah. And there's one person and two people in the room today that are from my area that have heard this many times. And how I got there, I was in a little suburb of the district called Como Manor. That could have happened in Macon, too. And a film would get over my eyes. And I'd ever ate that I remember. Really, the last day I drank, I weighed 123 pounds when they locked me up, anyway. And I was standing, and I always needed a quarter. My pitch was for a quarter. I'd been doing this a long time. And there was a film in my over my eyes, and I couldn't see this guy. So I just, whatever it was, I just walked up to it and asked him for a quarter. And he kind of backed away. He said, "Man, what the hell is wrong with you?" Well, he had on two overcoats, too. And I couldn't see him. Yeah. And immediately, he took me around back in the building and gave me a drink of wine. Immediately. And we were fine. Now, there was three of us, three there when I arrived. Now, of course, I made four. And we went all the way back to the end of this little town, and that's where the Kenilworth Avenue dump started. They were filling it in at the time. It's since become a recreational area. And I sort of resent that they didn't name that after me, but they didn't. And they were filling it in, and this truck came in. We were walking, and that's all winos had to do that I associated with. And we stood there and watched this truck dump the bed of the thing, and a big piece of plywood fell out. And one of the guys mentioned we ought to go over there and build ourselves a shack, and maybe they'll leave us alone. I could have never thought of that. I mean, my thinking just wasn't, I couldn't think that well. But I said to myself, I don't know where you guys are going now, but I know I am. And that afternoon, after they stopped working, we went over there and we put up a makeshift shack well enough that we could sleep in it that night. And that's where I lived the last 10 months that I drank. Well, that's where I slept, anyway. And you know, being in construction, I continued to add on to that thing. I continued to make it more sturdy. Yeah. You know, that was just my thing. Of course, I had to protect us from the rats. They were big as cats. They really were. If none of us was ever bitten, they probably found something decent to eat. And I just kept adding on to that thing. And you know, I always wanted to put me a patio on the side of that shack. That was it. Yeah. I was going to build me a brick patio, and I was going to get me an orange crate or something and sit on there and drink my wild eyes rose. And that would be the ultimate in living, and I knew that. The ultimate in good living. And as I said, I'd get out of there early enough in the morning to go down. There's a thoroughfare there. It's named Bladensburg Road. That could have happened in Columbus, if there's a Bladensburg Road there. And I just would panhandle for a quarter until I got enough for 2 pints of wild ice rose. 57 cents a pint it was at the time. And you know, the last 2 years, I don't say this to offend or insult anybody, but it's the way it was in my life. The last 2 years that I drank, the front of my pants was wet most of the time. And that's just the way my life was. And I didn't care. I did not care. I didn't use that as a method to get to the panhandling. It's just the way it was. And see, my alcoholism was ugly and filthy and dirty and degrading and humiliating and everything in my life today that I want no parts of. No parts. I never once regurgitated when I was drinking. I never regurgitated. I'm looking forward to that someday. I always puke. Just plain and simple puke. You know, they could have taken me out of there. They could have sent a limousine from the White House, which would have been about a 15-minute ride. And they could have taken, it came to that shack, or near it anyway, and put a $300 tailor-made suit on me and dressed me up as fine as you could be dressed. And chauffeur drive me back to the White House and put me in Lincoln's bed. And I would have been just as sick. You see, Geographic says absolutely nothing to do with alcoholism. Nothing. We say in our area, puke is puking. It doesn't make any difference where you do it. You see, the only difference between me puking on that dump and you puking in your penthouse is you got to clean yours up. That's the only difference. Yeah. The last day I drank was December the 14th, 1966. Oh, it can be the last day. And the same thing had happened that day that happened the previous days, that I'd gone out and I'd panhandled and I'd got my 2 pints of wild ice rose and I was on my way back to the dump. And I was the happiest man in the county because I was getting away from people. And a guy pulled alongside me in a nice car, a beautiful car. Well, it should have been. He had stolen it. He had taken his pick. And he motioned me to get in his car, and I had never seen him before. But he had seen me. I know this down the area, and he knew I was all for this. And I didn't want to get in his car because, it was winter time, and he had the windows rolled up and the heater on. I knew that. And I could smell me out there, really. And he looked like a nice guy. I tell you what happened to me a lot. I would get my sleeping time mixed up to my going to the bathroom time a lot of times in that shack, and a lot of times I was doing both at the same time. And that makes a hell of a mess when all you can do is just wait and dry, because I didn't have a change of clothes. And the guy wanted me to get in his car, and I finally did. I was reluctant, I really was. And I got in, and I learned right away that he was a thief. A real bona fide thief. He didn't drink, and right away I didn't trust him. Right away. I had no trust in him whatsoever. He's 27 years old, and I know this now. And he had seen me in the area, and he was a type thief. Sick thief, they told me. He was a type guy that if he didn't steal something today, he wouldn't be able to sleep tonight. That's all I know. That's what they told me. And he had gone downtown before he stole the car, down in the district, and he had cased his building. And we sat there and looked at it. He said, "Now, when you get to this corner, you got to pick this up and run." I said, "You're crazy. I can hardly walk. Can't run." And he revised the whole plan. He said, "Now, when you get to this corner," he was so anxious. You know, he had to, just like almost like you when you need a drink. He said, "Now, when you get to this corner, you're going to have to run because there may be a security guy there." I said, "Forget it. I can't do any of that running." And I started to get out of the car. And he grabbed me by the arm, and I closed the door, and the most pathetic look I've seen before or since. He looked at me, he said, "You think you could blow the horn?" I said, "I can do that. I know I can blow the horn. I know that." And so, we just started to travel around, but he had too much at stake at this building. He really did. And he just nixed that. I really wish if I'd been in a little better shape, we'd have really had a haul. I can tell you, I was all for that. Or anything else like that, then. But he decided not to do that day. But as I said earlier, and I thank God for this, he had to steal something that day, or he wouldn't be able to sleep that night. So we started traveling, and we got on 301, going south. And just below La Plata, Maryland, we stopped and we robbed a man's place there. That's generally my home area. We were in this building, and we were robbing it. And I was all wind up as always, and it was nighttime. It was dark in the country, and I'm just standing there looking at him working on the safe, and he yells, "My God, the cop's outside!" And he started running toward the front of the building. Now this is a matter of record, and Leo has heard this many times. He started running toward the front of the building, and I just started sashaying toward the back because all I was doing was waiting for him to open the safe. I really felt that I was as safe there as I feel I am here now. My sanity was just, I didn't think I'd do anything. And I went on back, and I was a half bath back there. And I went in, and I turned on the light. And I closed the door, the little country place, and I put the latch on the door, the little thing. And I took my pants down, put the seat down at the commode, and sat down as if I were in my home or yours. Knowing very well that nobody was going to bother me there. Especially for using the bathroom. And I really thought that. And I could hear him out there, and I said to myself, "That guy's in a lot of trouble. He's in a lot of trouble." Yeah. And I could hear this commotion, and I started thinking, I was worried about? I was worried about my transportation home. I was worried about how I was going to get home. And he had 4 or 5 cars out there waiting to transport me anywhere they wanted me to go. But I was just thinking that I was as safe there as I am here. Really. And I was just sick. And then finally the guy, Officer Poole, he's a good friend of mine now, he's a sergeant now. He came back and knocked on the door with his billy, and I said, "Now, you know, this bastard's got a nerve here. Man trying to use the bathroom." And I didn't open the door, so he kicked it in. It wasn't a lot of effort. He just kicked the latch, and the latch came in. And he had his gun in his hand. And I grabbed for my pants. And we had a hell of a time. I had a hell of a time. He didn't have a hell of a time. And he finally got us in jail in La Plata that night. And that was my 12th time that I had been in jail doing my drinking experience. And most of it was just drunken, disorderly, just different things that I won't bother to go into. But that was my 12th time. But I know they're in real serious problem, a trouble. And I got in jail there, which was the summer of the 14th, 1966. And I stayed there. I was there for 4 or 5 days, and I was fine. There wasn't anything wrong with me. I hadn't started to eat yet, but I was fine. And on the 5th day, I went into what they now tell me was delayed DTs, and I damn near died. I did everything in that cell but kill myself, literally. There were 2 men cages there, and they had 2 men to a cage. There was a guy in there with me, and how they treated us in. When I went into this DTs and I became a maniac, which is what I was, they took the other guy for his protection, and they just left me in there to do my thing. And whatever that was, you know. And they tell me the jailer would just come falling up on the stairwell. He and his wife lived downstairs just to see whether or not I was dead. And I went back many, many times after that. I'm in a little plate at least once a week now. But I went back many, many times after I got sober and asked him why he didn't send some medical attention for me. And he said they don't send that kind of stuff to the jail. The only thing they send there is the truck to pick the body up. Now, you know, that's 11 and a half years ago, and I'll bet my life standing here this minute, and that's high stakes, that if there's a man in that same cage going into DTs this moment, he will be treated exactly the same way. That hadn't changed a bit. So that's all I have to look forward to if I drink again. Or worse. I stayed there for 45 days. I was there Christmas and New Year, 66 and 67. And on January 30th, 1967, I was tried and convicted of grand larceny. And I was sentenced to 2 years to the Maryland House of Correction. It's Maryland State Prison is what it is. And a judge there in La Plata, his name is J. Dudley Diggs, he looked down at me over his glasses and he said, "Mr. Bennett," he said, "I think you're worth saving." He goes, I agreed with him. What the hell? And he suspended a 2-year sentence, prison sentence, and he court-ordered me for 6 months to the Crownsville State Hospital. Now, that is predominantly a mental institution, and it's near Annapolis. And they have 2 cottages set aside in there for the alcoholic program. And my court order read that I was to be there for at least 6 months, or that I was to be committed there until I was no longer of any danger to myself or the community, which could have been forever. And when they took me in Crownsville that afternoon and weighed me, I weighed 131 pounds. And I was damn near dead. And I'd been 45 days in jail. And that's not being dramatic. It's just the way it was. And I have to remember that. I say most of these things so I can hear them. Because it's awful hard for me at times to remember that that guy wore my clothes or that I wore his. And I just have to keep saying that so I can know that it was me. I stayed in Crownsville 4.5 months. And they had these strange, freaky acting people called AAs coming in out of Baltimore. Strange acting people. Strange. Freaky. Now listen, my attitude has changed about a lot of things in my life, and this is one of them. But this was what my thinking at the time. They'd come in there all mossed, 2 carloads, 8 or 10 people, all dressed nice, and we were 110 strong, the cadre, zombies is what we were, and we'd sit out there, and these people would come in there, and they'd start talking about Jesus. I knew there was something wrong with them right away. I knew that. That was only for real old ladies and little girls. Men didn't have anything to do that. I knew that. And they'd get up, and the young guy would, they just acted so strange. The young guy would start talking about loving the old man. That wasn't bad. And then the old man started talking about loving the young guy. And, but when the young guys got up and started loving the young guy, I said, my Lord, what is this? And then after the meet was over, the Our Father, they'd come around each other and hold each other's hands, you know, like, and after the meet was over, they'd be, look like kissing each other to me. And they'd walk through the audience and want to shake my hand. I said, don't you touch me. Not me. Not me. No. I just wasn't ready for that, but I'll tell you one thing, that has all changed now. They love me, and I know that now. And there are many, many, many men in this world today that I love. And I feel so good to be able to say that. So good. And they were fine people. And I'm all right, too, in case you catch me in the men's room when this is over. On June 6, 1967, they released me from Crownsville. Now, I hadn't had a drink for 6 months, so 45 days in La Plata, and then 4.5 months in Crownsville, but that's all I hadn't had. Nothing else about my life had changed any. I didn't pay any attention to these people. I went in there, and all that happened to me that I had been physically removed from the drug alcohol. Nothing else had happened. And Bill says, and as Bill sees it on the first page of the first paragraph of the first page, he says, if you're a real alk and if you don't have a profound personality change, you'll get drunk again. Now, if you're black or white, red or yellow, a man or woman, short or tall, doesn't make any difference. If we don't have this profound personality change, we'll be drunk again. And I think that comes about by the endeavor of the 12 suggested steps. And on June 6, 1967, they released me from there, and I went home to a wife that didn't want me or need me. And the boy had gone back to school. He was 12 now, and he had never seen me sober in his lifetime. He was 12 years old. And they were home there. She was in her apartment, and she was doing a fine job of raising him, and they certainly didn't need me. But you see, I was going to leave Crownsville, and I was going to go home, and I was going to take charge again. You know, I was always a take charge guy. And she had other ideas. And I didn't understand that. Well, she had the nerve to tell me that I was all right for me to stay in her apartment and sleep on the couch until I was financially able to move on. And I didn't know how to handle that. I didn't know how to handle that. And when I left Crownsville that morning, the last thought in my mind was to ever attend an AA meeting. I know I was so happy to get away from that. But I came home, and in 10 hours, I'd been in society, and I was just in a state of total despair again. I didn't know which way to go. And I remembered it was the grace of God, and I know that like a light bulb going on in my head, that somebody had suggested to me that I attend an AA meeting the night of the day that I was released from Crownsville. And, you know, the moment that that came to my mind, I became calm. There was a calmness that came over me that I never before in my life experienced. And I knew that if I could get to where the people were like the people who were coming into Crownsville, that I would be all right. And I went to my first outside AA meeting that night. And it was at the St. Barnabas Group on St. Barnabas Road in Oxon Hill, Maryland. And when I walked into that room, when they released me from Crownsville that morning, they gave me a state shirt and a state pair of trousers and the shoes that they had issued me when I went there with. I didn't have a dime, and most important of all, I didn't have a friend. And I was 38 years old. Absolute zero. And only had 5 teeth. And I like peanuts. I probably shouldn't even mention that in this state, but I like peanuts. And none of my teeth were over the other. And And I weighed 138 pounds. So that's what I brought to you. That's exactly what I presented to Alcoholics Anonymous June 6, 1967. And I was scared to death. Get to death. I didn't even have confidence in myself to think that I could walk. I remember one time in Crownsville, they'd come and get us, some of us that were going to be there forever anyway, and if neighborhood people would come get us and pay us $5 a day and give us a glass of milk and a sandwich at lunchtime and set us on the back porch, and I know that feeling too, and like we were something else, not to be touched, you know. And I was working for a guy one day, and he asked me to move his truck in a field from one spot to the other, and I couldn't have hit anything, and I was afraid to try to drive it. And I got my initial permit when I was 16, the day that I turned 16. I had absolutely no confidence whatsoever. And on that day that I came to AA, I just kept coming. I just kept coming. And I kept following people around in AA, much like the way I followed people around that had that bottle of wine. And I was afraid to say anything to them, afraid they'd expel me or something. Because I knew that these people here knew something. And I knew that if I kept coming back, I might learn. And I just kept coming. I just kept coming. I went back to work as a laborer. And I wasn't about to tell anybody that I was a mechanic because I knew I could never do that again. And I made some money, and I was still sleeping on a couch where my wife lived in her apartment. And I got some money together, and people kept telling me if I kept coming to AA and I didn't take a drink, that my life would get better. And I really didn't believe that. I just couldn't believe that. I couldn't comprehend me ever getting on your side of the street. It was just too much for me to imagine. And I know every night for 4 months, there was somebody at my door to take me to and bring me from an AA meeting. Every night. And I went every night. I went each and every night for at least 2 years the initial, because I wasn't in very much demand anywhere else. So I just kept going to AA. And after this 4 months, I had $125 together, and I bought me a little car. A little Hillman. But that big. More proud of that car, that vehicle, than anything I've ever owned before or since. I tell you, it solved one problem. It was so small, it solved one problem for me. I never worried about running over dogs. I could run under them. And I'd get in that thing at 7 o'clock every night and go to the meeting and park right in front of the door where everybody had to walk around that and say, that's Ray Bennett's car there. I said, that's right. That's right. Yeah. And I felt so good. I could come and go anytime I wanted to. Anytime. And there was no restrictions on that. And then it started to dawn on me that maybe my life would get better. Just maybe. By chance, if I just kept coming. And some people would call me and ask me to take them to meetings. One time. They wouldn't just want that, and that's all they wanted of that. And I just kept coming. Now, you know, they used to say that. Keep coming back, keep coming. I thought that was the damnedest thing I'd ever heard in my life. But that's where it's at. Just keep coming. My wife and I, she's since become my children's mother, we lived together for 4 years, and we tried everything known to man and anybody else to save our marriage. All the counseling, all the Al-Anon, and all the things that we could find. We met a baby. I didn't think it was a good idea at the time, and I still don't think it was a good idea because of our age, but I thank God we did. We tried to save our marriage. He's 9 years old now, and he is my AA baby, and he thinks I'm the greatest thing on this planet. And I said, that's right. That's right. And after 4 years, we sat down one night and we decided that we both deserved better. There had never been nothing, no man, no woman involved in nothing like that. It's just that I think our marriage was over before I had my last drink. But we tried, and I thank God we did. And I said, well, in 10 days, I'd be gone. I don't know why I said 10 days, and on the 10th day, I was packed and I left. And that's been almost 5 years ago now. No, 7 years ago. We've been divorced 5 years. I'm going to say that again. I've been divorced 5 years. And I left there, and I kept up the responsibility. I wanted to do that, the financial responsibility to that household. But you know, had I not been a member of this program, I would have gone over the back door. I would not have tried to have done that. But I did, and I thank God that I did. And for each day that I have been separated from my two sons, and when I'm in town, unless I'm on vacation or traveling, I call them and talk to them every day. Each and every day. Both of them. And that's been almost 7 years now. And they come to my home, we just have the finest rapport. Especially my 22-year-old. He's a man now. He wants to be a plumber. And he's going to be a good one, I think. And he's a fine young man. And as I said, my 9-year-old. My children's mother, well, she's working on it. She'll get better. I'm sure she's she's a fine human being. She really is. My mother and my brothers and my sisters, and we had such a hard time, they're fine. They are fine. They went the road that I tried to go, and if money is a criterion for success, well, I guess they're successful. My mother, when she retired, was able to build her own small retirement house. And it's just something that I thought I'd let you know. As far as I'm concerned, Alcoholics Anonymous is the best thing that's ever happened to me, bar nothing. Bar absolutely nothing. Today, the most important thing in my life is that I know God loves me. And you know, if I had known that from age 8 to 17, maybe my life or my thinking or my attitudes would have been different, but I didn't know it then, but I know it now. And below that, everything else comes. And I have gotten to a place in my life today where there are no longer any big deals. All my life, everything was a big deal. All my life. And the reason everything was a big deal was because I was taking me so serious. I was the center of the universe. And everything revolved around me. Everything. And any time I get any kind of an inclination that I'm a big deal anymore, I laugh aloud. I actually laugh aloud. Because I know that's not true. And there never were any big deals. It's just what I conjured up in my sick thinking. Financially, I have much more of everything than I need. I have more beds than I need, more clothes than I need, more vehicles than I need, more money than I need. I said that the other night at a meeting, the guy in the back said, well, you can give me some of that. I don't mean it that way. I do not mean it by any stretch of the imagination that way. You see, I like to qualify that by saying I know we'll have everything I want, but I want what I have. And I'm grateful for that. And I just keep coming here. And I think one of the biggest reasons that I keep coming to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I come on a daily basis, I go every day, is I've learned now in my almost 12 years that the only part of this program that I get to keep is the part that I'm willing to give away. And that's incredible. But that's the way it is for me. And I just keep coming here. And I hope you do too. And while we're here, we might as well stay. We might as well, because if you're thinking for a place down the road further to go for help, you can forget it. This is the end of the line here. If you go back, it's a physical, mental, and spiritual illness. Now, if you go back to your doctor, get drunk and go back to your doctor, or me, I'm certainly not immune from any of these things. And I get drunk and I go back to my doctor, he's going to send me back to Alcoholics Anonymous. And if I get drunk and go to my psychiatrist, he's going to send me back here. And I'll tell you, I like to put this little footnote here. A lot of the psychiatrists have begun to treat alcoholism as if it were a Librium deficiency. Now, if you have a psychiatrist, he's giving you any of those cute little pills, I would talk with my sponsor about those. And I'm certainly not trying to play doctor. I don't mean that by any stretch. And if you go back to your clergy, what the hell, he may want to come with you. So, while we're here, we might as well stay. It's been an honor for me to be in Atlanta. I want to thank Joe and the committee for having me here. I want to thank each of you for being here, to share your experience and your strength and your hope with me. But most important of all, I want to thank the God of my understanding for my sobriety. God bless you.